Today on the 21st, people call Amazon the everything store, but not long ago that distinction went to an Illinois company.
Why do I shop at Sears? It's easy for me. I can pick up tennis balls, children's clothing, torque wrenches, and a dish all in the same shop.
But keeping Sears in Illinois came at a cost of hundreds of millions of dollars in tax breaks. We'll talk to a reporter who investigated whether it was worth it. Then, can you tell the difference between a Quad Cities accent and one in Chicago, or maybe even Carbondale? Yes, Illinois has accents, and we'll explore them with a linguist. And with billions of people staying home across the globe during the pandemic, we'll ask Illinois scientists about the positive and negative environmental effects that's had. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on the 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, and WNIJ in DeKalb. But first, the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Nowadays, you can get whatever you want on the internet. This is how Amazon came to be known as the Everything Store. But not long ago, if you wanted to be able to shop for clothes, tools, toys, a haircut, and maybe new tires, there's a good chance your Everything Store was a company based right here in Illinois.
Does fighting traffic when you shop almost make you blow your top? Put an end to traffic fears. It's very easy to get to Sears.
Why do I shop at Sears? It's easy for me. I can pick up tennis balls, children's clothing, torque wrenches, and a dish all in the same shop. Use my charge card, and it's just simple and easy.
Last year, Sears tuned up 1 million engines. At Sears, we install confidence. Best of all, we do it right next door to all this.
There's more for your life.
Sears was a retail colossus, but it was based right here in Illinois. But keeping that company here in Illinois came at a cost of hundreds of millions of dollars in tax breaks. And there's a question around that. Was it worth it? This was the subject of a recent investigation by ProPublica and the Daily Herald newspaper based in Chicago's northwest suburbs. The reporter behind that story is David Bernstein. He's an investigative journalist from the Chicago area and a local reporting network fellow at ProPublica. David, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Brian. Thanks for having me.
So for our listeners who might be on the younger side, and maybe they've only known Sears as a struggling and recently bankrupt retailer, can you remind us of what this company once was?
Yeah, it was the Amazon of its day. It was, I mean, this is a, it started in the 19th century. It started as a watch company originally by a Minnesota train employee who happened to come upon a box of watches that were unsold, and he sold them at the train station and made some money and said, hey, this could be a business. And so eventually he moved to Chicago and started it as a watch company, and it soon started selling everything, and it became the world's largest retailer because based on catalog sales, you could basically sell things that you couldn't get everywhere, that you might be able to only buy in a city. You could now find wherever you lived. You could get appliances, and you could get clothes, and you could get all the tools and all these things that Americans needed, and Sears provided that to the world, and it grew and grew and grew, and it became the Amazon of its day.
Am I remembering correctly that you could once like order a Conestoga wagon and then a house, like a modular house at
you
one
could,
point?
You could literally buy your house from Sears. They had a home division that sold, that you could pick your house out of a catalog, and you could pick the finishes, you could pick the style. There's actually several communities in the Chicagoland area that have a number of Sears homes, and it's become, there's sort of a kind of a subculture of historians who like to try to find Sears houses around the country.
And as a symbol of that dominance, the company occupied a pretty significant piece of real estate in downtown Chicago, right? People will remember the Sears Tower.
Sure, they did. They moved. Originally, they were in the North Lawndale area. They had off of Holman Square neighborhood, and then they built the Sears Tower, which became they wanted to make a statement. They were the largest retailer in the world, and they wanted to show the world that they were a mighty, mighty company, and they built the tallest building in the world to prove it. And in 1988 and 99, they decided to sell the Sears Tower, and that sort of led to the move to eventually to Hoffman Estates.
Yeah. So tell me what was that? So that's Sears. That's where Sears was as we come to the start of your story in 1989. What was Hoffman Estates? This is not like a place with like a main street and, you know, the old railroad town or anything like that from the 1800s.
Right. No, this was up until the mid 1950s. It was mostly cornfields and soybean fields and farmland. And a father-son builder, Jack and Sam Hoffman, who lived in the Phoenix area, had heard that the state was going to be building a tollway out in that area, and they decided to basically buy some farmland up there as sort of speculative to start a new community. They bought about 160 acres, and they built a subdivision of houses, and those sold out quickly. And this was a time in the 50s when a lot of people were leaving the city and were looking for more affordable housing in the, you know, the far flung sort of suburbs of Cook County. So it sort of grew very quickly into this bedroom community of a lot of housing. And what it sort of, as it grew, it also sort of grew in an identity, inferiority complex to its neighbor Schaumburg, Schaumburg was this sort of suburb that was kind of the powerhouse of the Northwest suburbs. And it had a big shopping mall, and it had a lot of office buildings. And it was basically a big commercial center of that area. And they sort of, the leaders of Hoffman Estates sort of looked with envy to Schaumburg to say, hey, we want some of that tax dollars. And so how do we get that?
All right. So let's, and if you're just joining us, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with David Bernstein about his series of stories from ProPublica and the Daily Herald about Sears and the tax breaks it wrung from local communities in the state over the years. So let's start where go to where your story starts, I should say, which is sure. Wrigley Field, June 1989, Expos at Cubs. What happens at that game that's significant to this story?
Well, the Cubs lost 5-0, and the Expos knocked them out of first place. But the real story there was what was happening kind of behind the scenes. And you know, as I said earlier, the Sears had made the decision to sell the Sears Tower, and they were looking for a large tract of land. They wanted a suburban campus in a metro area. They had certain criteria. They wanted to be near an airport. They wanted to have good transportation access off of a highway and that sort of thing. And they were looking at a number of cities and a number of states. Dallas was a big contender. Charlotte in North Carolina was a big contender. And they were competing fiercely for Sears to move there. And at the time, Governor James Thompson did not want to see that happen. And he sort of pulled out all the stops. And the city, the governor's office and the company executives had been negotiating for months, kind of quietly behind closed doors. And they were really worried about about losing Sears and all these jobs. At the time, Sears had about 6,000 jobs at its headquarters. And that's a lot of jobs, and losing just sort of the prestige. This was a sort of a period in the 80s when Chicago and Illinois as a whole was sort of struggling, kind of in the sort of an economic downturn, and they were seeing sort of factories close, and they really were desperate to try to avoid becoming a Rust Belt state and a Rust Belt city in Chicago being a Rust Belt city.
Right. Do we go the way of Cleveland and Detroit?
Exactly. Exactly. And that was a big fear. And so you saw at the time that these that states were starting to compete really fiercely for foreign auto businesses, factories like Honda and Toyota and companies and Volkswagen and companies that were foreign car dealers who were sort of building factories in the Midwest and in other places. And they were throwing money and incentives at these car dealerships, these car companies to come to their state. And so this was one of the first times a big headquarters had decided to kind of pull the same sort of stunt where they sort of announce that they're going to be moving and they sort of start taking, it was almost like an auction. States were putting together bids and proposals, And Governor Thompson did not want to see them leave, and so they met at a Cubs game, and they sealed the deal there. And the deal was that Hoffman, that the company was going to move to Hoffman Estates, which was and they were going to be given a really sweet land deal where they would get 800 acres of prime real estate right off of the tollway for virtually free. They were going to create a basically what is called a tax increment financing district, which is a basically like an abate, a property tax abatement district, where the money goes, where all the tax dollars, the property tax dollars that are created out of this district go back into the district instead of the local taxing districts.
So how much money ultimately is the deal for Sears in terms of all the, you know, all in, all the governments that yeah, gave this tax money to Sears? How much is this worth to Sears over the years?
It's a good question. It's a hard one to answer. And say they were awarded over $500 million in what they were awarded.
I want to emphasize that you said $500 million with a B, $500 million.
Yes, there were basically two deals. There was the original deal in 1989, which was the state kicked in about it was supposed to be about $60 million for infrastructure improvements to the area, and it became $80 million with overruns. And then the village of Hoffman Estates created a this TIF district. And so one of the things that was very important to Sears is they wanted a lot of land for their headquarters, which was a massive building. It's about, you know, almost half the size of the Pentagon. And it's so they wanted a lot for their headquarters, but they also wanted extra land that they could develop for themselves. They would be the developers, and they would build an office park on it. And then they would become the landlord. They would collect all this. They would collect all this money. One of the big regrets they had with the Sears Tower is they were one of the early pioneers to move kind of to the western sort of southwestern fringes of the loop. And when they moved there into the Sears Tower, they saw all these other buildings crop up, and they missed out on what they thought was a lot of potential real estate money. And so they wanted to have extra land to develop for their own. And so they were basically given this land, almost 800 acres to develop for themselves.
So we, and I should say, you're listening to the 21st. We're speaking with David Bernstein about his piece for ProPublica and the Daily Herald at a great price, the true cost of the Sears headquarters deal. And we've only got about 4 minutes left in our conversation, so I want to kind of move quickly through a couple of areas here.
Sure.
You wrote about the real costs this imposed on local governments, and by extension, the people who rely on those governments for services like educating their children. Can you tell me a little bit about District 300 and what their claims are?
Sure. So District 300 is a school district that's based in Algonquin, and it's a huge school district. It's 118 miles. It just so happens that the district overlaps with the Sears TIF area, with the economic area that was made for Sears. And so as part of that, the tax dollars that get generated by the Sears headquarters, millions and millions of dollars every year, and by the other office buildings and other retail and restaurants that have now since come to that area, all that money, normally 60% of that property taxes in the state go to the local school district. Here, the money gets diverted into a fund that gets then redistributed mostly to Sears. For developing the area. So on one hand, the argument can be made that beforehand it was just cornfields, and they weren't getting much anyway. And so all of this is extra money that they're receiving anyway, and it's been great for the school district. But the school district has been missing out on hundreds of millions of dollars over the 30 years of that would have normally gone to the school district. And when in 2012, when they extended the deal, normally the original 1989 deal went for 23 years, just like a normal TIF does. And in 2011, Sears threatened to move out of the state again. And in 2012, the state passed a 15-year extension. So the actual TIF district, the special taxing district for Sears, won't expire until 2027.
Wow. And there's so much in your story that, that we're not going to have time to get to. And I will say we will tweet out a link to it at our show page, which is 21st Show on Twitter, 21st Show, and also 21stshow.org. You know, there's a great, a whole story you have about how Sears was, you know, in terms of like living up to its commitment, it was counting baristas and janitors in the number of people that it said it employed. But I want to sort of step back and look at the big picture here. The bottom line lesson in your story, I think, is like, we should be examining maybe what we're using these, you know, so-called tax incentives for luring businesses. What did you come away with thinking about tax incentives as a matter of state and local government policy? And again, we have about a minute left.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I think when in this time, especially with when coronavirus makes us is blowing a huge budget hole in all of the municipality budgets, you have to think about how you spend your money wisely. Is giving one single company $500 million in tax incentives a good deal? Especially a company that now is in 2018 went bankrupt. One of the things is that these deals become very easy for politicians to pass, and they after they get done, few people are even looking at whether they're effective or successful, or if they're good deals at all. They just sort of, and they don't, because they don't directly cost a taxpayer, you don't see it directly on your tax bill. It seems lost to a lot of people that they are actually paying more for this company. And at the time, it's, you know, Sears is still a multi-billion dollar company. Does it need tax incentives to move? These are questions, especially when resources are tight, that I think elected officials need to be thinking about.
David Bernstein is an investigative journalist from the Chicago area. His story was produced for the Local Reporting Network at ProPublica and the Daily Herald. It's called At a Great Price, The True Cost of the Sears Headquarters Deal. Like I said, we'll tweet it out. We'll put it on our show page. It's well worth reading. David, thanks so much for being here today on the 21st.
Thank you, Brian. It was a pleasure. I appreciate it.
More to come after a short break. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. When people outside of our state think of the, quote, Illinois accent, they might be thinking of this.
What is God's role in this? Obviously, he's rooting for the Bears.
Otherwise, he wouldn't have put them in Chicago.
That's right.
That is the Saturday Night Live sketch from 1991, The Bears, with Chris Farley and Mike Myers. I will stop, I promise. As our next guest will tell you, that's just one of many accents you'll find in Illinois. Matthew Gordon is with us now. He's a linguist who has studied Midwest dialects and language change and is a professor of English at the University of Missouri in Columbia. Or is that the University of Missouri in Columbia? Either way, Professor Gordon, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here today.
Oh, very happy to be here. Thanks.
So would you say that Illinois has an accent?
Yeah, certainly not just a single accent. In fact, I think it's probably pretty difficult to find any state that has a single accent. But Illinois in particular, like a lot of Midwestern states, has a real mixture of accents.
And is it, I guess, this idea, how is that divided up? Is it an urban-rural thing or more just, you know, generally geographic across the state?
Yeah, when linguists look at these kinds of issues, we often try to distinguish between what we might call traditional regional dialects and then some more current patterns. So the traditional regional differences are based largely on the settlement, American settlement, by English speakers. So in that sense, Illinois is very much like Ohio and Indiana and even Missouri to an extent, where you have really three different large regions represented at the extreme northern tier of counties, including Chicago. So basically anything above Interstate 80, that would represent the northern dialect region, which extends, you know, across the Great Lakes and into places like New York and even New England. And then from basically I-80 all the way down to extreme southern Illinois, you have what would broadly be defined as the Midland dialect region. And then in the southern tier, right along the Ohio River and places like Cairo and even Carbondale, you have more of a southern or south Midland dialect area.
Okay, so those are some of the dialect lines. Now let's talk about pronunciations within sure. those dialects. And one of the examples that you use is or that I've heard used, I guess, anyways, is the words caught versus caught and the idea that they're merging. Can you explain a little bit more about exactly sure. what words I'm using and yeah. what that's about?
Yeah. Just for those for people who are who have this merger, we're talking about the word C-O-T, like the sort of cheap bed, caught, and the past tense of catch, C-A-U-G-H-T. So those were, and it's, of course, it's not just those words, but it's the vowels that are represented in those words. So it would also include words like don, D-O-N, and dawn, D-A-W-N. So any of those, so in many parts of the country, those are two separate vowel sounds, ah versus an aw. Increasingly in large parts of the country, they're sort of merged into a single vowel sound. So rather than distinct don versus dawn or caught versus caught, you get don and caught.
And I was just going to ask if there are certain regions of Illinois that are more likely to have this merger of sounds as opposed to others.
Yeah. So that particular feature is very widespread. So it basically cuts across the middle of Illinois. So anywhere in that traditional Midland dialect region, it would be very common. But it's important to note, this is a fairly recent change that's happening. So this is something where you might find the people in central Illinois, if they're over the age of 50 or 60, they might have a distinction, whereas younger people would be much more likely to not have a distinction. So that makes it a very interesting pattern, because it's a good example of a change that's happening sort of within a single person's lifetime. And you can really trace it that way. It's also interesting to me as a linguist, because it's one of these features that people aren't really aware of. I'm sure there are lots of pronunciation differences and grammatical differences and even word differences that people point to and say, oh, you must be from such and such place because of the way you said that. This is not one that people really notice, right? It's kind of very much under the radar.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see if we can hear it now. We've enlisted the help of some of our friends in the Illinois Public Radio system, and we're going to start up north. We've got Yvonne, who is a reporter at WNIJ Radio in DeKalb. Let's see if she has the caught versus caught merger.
My name is Yvonne Booz. I grew up in the Chicagoland area. Caught, caught.
Again, that was Yvonne from Chicagoland. Now we have her colleague, Jenna Dooley, also at our partner station, WNIJ. And let's see if Jenna has the merger.
My name is Jenna Dooley. I grew up in Orion, Illinois, near the Quad Cities. Caught, caught.
So I think it sounds to me like neither Jenna, originally from the Quad Cities, or Yvonne from Chicagoland have that caught, caught merger. They seem to pronounce those words distinctly. Is that what you hear?
Yeah, that's what I heard. It's very short, and it's often difficult to hear in isolation like that, but I think you're right. They seem to have a difference.
Okay, so Jenna is from northwestern Illinois. Yvonne is from northern Illinois. What are some of the things that set a northern Illinois accent apart from, say, a southern Illinois accent?
Well, the traditional one, which is kind of represented in that Saturday Night Live skit of the Bears, right, the sort of stereotypical Chicago accent, illustrates this phenomenon that linguists call the northern cities shift, shift meaning the changing patterns of vowels there. And so it would include things like the changing of the a sound of a word like cat. So instead of pronouncing cat with your tongue low in the mouth, it might be raised higher. So you might say, instead of cat, you might say cat, right? And another feature that's very dominant there is the ah vowel of a word like lock. So instead of lock, it might sound more like lack.
Lock,
so those are
yeah.
just a couple features. It's actually a fairly complex issue that involves six different vowels sort of moving around there. But that's a feature that's found in traditional Chicago speech and across the northern tier of Illinois. It's also common in places further north in Wisconsin and in Michigan and so forth.
You know, I do seem to remember my mom giving me a little guff of when I would sort of verge into the Chicago pronunciation of the city name. So this is not about a Chicago accent versus the rest of Illinois accent. There are more than two accents in the state.
Sure. Yeah.
So we have a few more examples here, this time from our public radio friends in the southern part of the state. We asked them to pronounce a specific list of words so we could hear the vowel sounds. Here they are.
My name is Kevin Boucher, and I'm a reporter, one of the reporters, at WSIU Radio in Carbondale, Illinois, in the southern part of the state. I grew up in Murfreesboro, basically, and here is how I would pronounce the following words. Caught, cot, cat, bit, bet, and butt.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Fuller. I grew up in Carterville, Illinois. The words you've asked me to say are caught, cot, cat, bit, bet, and butt. Thanks.
And here is Dan Mihalopoulos from WBEZ in Chicago.
This is Dan Mihalopoulos from WBEZ Chicago. I was born in Chicago, went to high school in Des Plaines out by O'Hare Airport, and let me just say caught, cot, cat, bit, bet, and butt.
So would you be able to distinguish a Southern Illinois accent from a Northern Illinois accent based on their pronunciation of these words?
Well, with some of these, there's some elements of that. Of course, it's important to note that not only are there age differences with some of these features, but of course, there's a general tendency for education and social class to play a role. So a lot of the more traditional regional features are more common among less educated people, among working class people. Education tends to, as I'm sure many people have experienced, it tends to wipe out or discourage people from their sort of rural or local identity in their dialect usage there.
Why is that? Is that a function of teachers or parents and people saying, like, you know, we're gonna leave this behind when we move to the big city, you know, we don't want to sound rural or something like that? Or why is it that it's a class or education issue, as you said?
Yeah, I think education in general does a lot to try to promote a homogeneous form of language. It thinks a lot in terms of correctness and incorrectness. And when that comes to regional pronunciations, that's just generally discouraged. So I think it's part of a broader phenomenon that fits in with a sort of general approach to English language teaching in our educational system.
So if you're just joining us, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Matt Gordon, a professor of linguistics at the University of Missouri, about Illinois accents, regional dialects and accents in Illinois. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about accents crossing racial and ethnic boundaries. I wonder if migration patterns, like the great migration of African Americans to Chicago in the 1900s, affected accents in Illinois, or if we're seeing influence from more recent immigrants from Latin or Asian countries that have played a role here.
Yeah, that's a hugely important factor. In a lot of these features, like the northern cities shift that I mentioned, that is found primarily only among white speakers, at least in the Chicago area. I did a little bit of research a number of years ago looking at this. So African Americans and Latino speakers don't generally have these features. So they're more traditional feature of white speech there. So those differences are common, in part for the reasons that you mentioned. So the Great Migration in the early part of the 20th century brought a lot of people from the South, a lot of African American people from the South. And so there remain ties between African-American speech patterns in northern places, St. Louis and Chicago and so forth, and the southern roots. So a lot of the features that we associate with southern speech are also found in African-American speech in the north. And that's just because of the fact that they go back just a couple generations to southern communities. There's also a a fair number of white speakers who moved north for factory jobs and so forth from Appalachia and so forth. And you see those same differences between the people who relatively recent second or third generation Appalachians in places like Detroit or even Chicago, and their speech would be separate from people who have been there for more than just a couple generations. So those kinds of racial and ethnic differences are a huge factor in terms of this. Because again, it makes sense when you think about the fact that the language and accent is a huge part of this, is a marker of your identity. And racial and ethnic identities, and just like other aspects of our identity, are something that we like to mark. And so it makes sense that it would come out in our speech.
Yeah, and you mentioned, I mean, it is a sense of identity. And sometimes, I guess, and this maybe gets into the class thing you were mentioning a moment ago, people want to leave past identities behind. We got a tweet from someone who said, "I have the accent of an ex-small town girl trying real hard not to say crick or warsh." I guess meaning creek or wash would be the way those are phrased. I wonder if you have a view on the pronunciation of our state name. Is it Illinois? Illinois? Is that just a simple mispronunciation, or is that evidence of some linguistic shift underfoot?
Yeah, that is a very popular topic, isn't it? Yeah. So that one's interesting because, of course, you also get it at the other end, right? Some people say Illinois with an S or a Z at the end. But for the first vowel sound, yeah, that's part of a larger set. So there's a small set of words where the I appears before an L. So you have Illinois, but you also have milk and milk. And sometimes you get pillow and pillow. So what's important to note about that is it's always before an L sound that you get that kind of variation. So that tells us that it's part of a larger sort of historical set. That one's pretty well known. It's pretty common across the Midwest, the Midland area there. I grew up in Nebraska, and I certainly have that in my own speech with pillow and Illinois, not so much milk, but so it's a pretty widespread phenomenon.
So we've got just a couple of minutes left in our conversation. English is always evolving. English speakers no longer sound Shakespearean, and I guess it's mostly, or I wonder, is it mostly in our pronunciation, or, you know, what is the most active way that language is changing now in Illinois or in the broader Midwest?
Well, all aspects of language change. They change, you know, they're always in a state of change. I think pronunciation is probably a very active area. But when it comes to language change, probably the most productive area is in terms of vocabulary. There are new terms and new words that are getting used. And with the mass communication that we have today, with Twitter, with other kinds of internet media, the spread of these words is much quicker. So there's been a lot of interesting research going on in linguistics where people have traced the spread of words over things like Twitter or other kinds of social media. And you can see where previously only the cool people who lived in a particular area knew what the neat word was for something. Now, if they use it on Twitter, then people even in rural Illinois and Nebraska and so forth can pick up on these cool slang terms. So that's just accelerated tremendously, the spread of new words and new usages. But pronunciation continues to evolve and continues to be used as a marker of local identity for sure.
That's the cat's pajamas, as my relatives would say. last question, and only about 30 seconds left. Do you think that regional accents among native English speakers are disappearing? Are we going to have a Chicago accent or a Murfreesboro accent generations from now?
Certainly, there will be some differences. They probably won't be the same ones that we're used to. A lot of very localized speech features are dying out, but new changes are happening all the time. So there'll always be differences based on region, based on other sorts of social identities within a particular region as well. So there'll be lots of work for linguists to do.
Well, we will look forward to continuing to follow your work in the years and maybe generations ahead. Matt Gordon is a professor of linguistics at the University of Missouri. Thank you so much for being here with us on the 21st today.
It was a pleasure. Thanks.
Coming up after a short break, we're going to be looking at the environmental effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. Many of us are not commuting to work anymore. Is that being good? Has that been good for our air quality and the environment? We will look at the science underlying some of the claims we've heard just ahead after a short break. This is the 21st. Stay with us. Thanks for being with us here on the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Over the past few months, billions of people have been home instead of commuting to work in their cars, taking a plane to an exotic vacation, or traveling for a business trip. Environmental scientists say we can already see the effects of our changing habits, both the positive ones, like less carbon dioxide emissions, and the negative ones, like more reliance on plastic. But the bigger question many scientists have is, how can we keep some of these good environmental habits when we return to whatever our new normal is going to be? For more on this, I'm joined now by Professor Anne-Marie Hansen. She's an environmental studies professor at the University of Illinois Springfield. Professor Hansen, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here and talk with you today.
Well, we're excited to have you. And I'd also like to welcome Scott Collis to the show. He's an atmospheric scientist in the Environmental Science Division at Argonne National Laboratory. Scott also heads the Geospatial Computing Innovations and Sensing Department for Argonne. Scott Collis, welcome to the 21st. That sounds very technical and exciting.
It's quite a mouthful, Brian. Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
So, Scott, although we would prefer it did not come, obviously, at the price of a global pandemic, I would imagine this is sort of an interesting time to be an atmospheric scientist. What else would you be able to put most of the, you know, when else could you put the world on hold for a few months to kind of conduct a natural experiment? Can you talk about this as a valuable moment for researchers?
Well, I don't think you could convince all the parents of Illinois and the United States to have their kids home for so long. So this definitely is forming what we like to call a natural experiment. Yes, we'd rather it be under certain different circumstances, but the sudden change, not just in certain sectors of economic activity, but across the board, has really had dramatic implications for emissions into our atmosphere.
And Professor Hansen, when we talk about the environment, I mean, we're talking about so many different factors. There's air pollution, waste, water quality. I wonder if you think some of the headlines that we've been seeing about environmental improvements lately are oversimplifying things at all. I mean, is the reality a little more complicated?
I suppose, yes. It is definitely more complicated, right? When we talk even, for example, just about the decrease in carbon dioxide emissions, that is just one greenhouse gas. So recent stories, for example, have shown how air pollution in some cities is still pretty bad, even as CO2 emissions go down, right? Because there are other types of greenhouse gases that linger in the air above certain environments for different periods of time. Also, because a lot of these changes with emissions and the goal of getting these emissions down, right, to avoid climate crisis in the future, scientists have been discussing this for a very long time. And some of the levels that we see the decrease immediately right now, those levels need to keep being sustained in the future for us to see significant long-term change, right? And making sort of the world more sustainable for our children and grandchildren.
So what are some of those changes that we have seen, in these positive changes?
I would say more at a local level, some of the positive changes, probably one of the most, a couple of the more interesting ones is that, as you say, that talking about having children at home, that's my 2-year-old.
This happens to me. Mine came into to my quote unquote studio home office yesterday. So it's okay.
He's got a lot of interesting ideas too. But what I was just going to say is probably one of the more widespread habits that we're seeing, at least around the country and even here in Illinois, is related to community resilience. A lot of people are doing what they can to support local businesses while they have to be closed for public health reasons, but in particular, more people are buying locally produced foods. Not just here in Illinois, but in many states, we actually see a surge of demand for community-supported agriculture. There's also been a big increase in things like home gardening or urban gardening, community-based gardening, right? Some of that is in response to, because people want to avoid large grocery stores, but also this is a really good thing because it's encouraging local food security. Right, there's been some comparisons of this recent surge in interest in gardening, to going back to thinking of the idea of victory gardens, right, where growing food was seen as supporting a national cause. So we're seeing some of those habits reemerging now. And all these things were trending even before the pandemic hit. And as we move forward, there's a lot of potential to sort of build on these new habits to contribute to long-term sustainability.
Okay, so that's what's happening at sort of the local micro level. Scott,
right,
I wonder, on a more macro level, you and other atmospheric scientists have been looking at images from space. What do those images look like now compared with a few months ago?
And so Anne's exactly right when it comes to CO2. I just wanted to point that out, that CO2 is what we call a very long-lived gas, so it takes sustained changes. One gas that actually has a much shorter lifetime and is a direct product of burning fuels, burning fossil fuels and petroleum, is nitrogen dioxide and other oxides of nitrogen, which is an ingredient to something we call photochemical smog. So there are two cameras that orbit the Earth, one on a European satellite, one on a NASA satellite, that take pictures of nitrogen dioxide from space. So nitrogen dioxide has a lifetime of about 8 to 10 hours. So you turn off a car, you turn off a factory, it decreases very quickly. So we're seeing, especially in these city centers, decreases of anywhere from around about, 10% to 25%. In these oxides of nitrogen compared to this time last year. So that's why you're seeing all these wonderful pictures of clear skies, nice, mountain ranges in Los Angeles, the Himalayas from India. Carbon dioxide is basically inert. There was a Nature paper published yesterday that shows that we've had about anywhere from 17 to 26% reduction in CO2 emissions. But that just takes us back to like 2006 levels. It's still going to take a long time for those long-lived greenhouse gases to come out of our atmosphere and stop being so harmful.
Yeah, and so I mean that's interesting, 2006 levels. And I've read that, I guess, because delivery trucks and over the road trucks are probably still operating, delivering goods and things to people, and power plants are still functioning. It's not like we've gone back to pre-industrial society levels of industrial activity, right?
And the funny thing is that we don't want to go back too far, because actually Chicago's air has been getting cleaner and cleaner over the last decades, thanks to the Clean Air Act and other things. So this latest reduction in activity has added a silver lining to that. But what it does do, and the take home I like to take from this, is it shows what's possible. Especially around my area in the suburbs of Chicago, just the reduction in traffic. I see people walking along the streets now, people riding their bikes more, which is both a blessing and can be problematic in terms of crowding. But this great natural experiment that is occurring in the midst of what is a disaster is also helping maybe shake us out of some of our habits, along the lines of what Anne Marie was saying in terms of people doing scratch baking right now.
So if you're just joining us, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. My guests are Scott Collis. He's an atmospheric scientist in the Environmental Science Division at Argonne National Laboratory. We're also speaking with Professor Anne Marie Hansen, who is an environmental studies professor at the University of Illinois Springfield. We're talking about some of the environmental consequences of people staying home during the coronavirus pandemic. We've talked now about some of the positive changes, but I want to move on to some of the concerning changes we've seen. And Professor Hansen, Earlier this year, I spoke with Illinois State Representative Ann Williams. She's a Democrat from Chicago. She's chair of the Green Caucus in the Illinois legislature. And she said a big issue in the Illinois legislature this year would not only be the Clean Energy Jobs Act and climate change,
but we also have another issue that will be an area of focus for the environmental community, and that is to address the growing and accelerating plastics pollution problem.
So plastics. You mentioned to one of our producers that unfortunately COVID-19 has actually reinvigorated our reliance on plastics in many ways. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, so definitely, I guess, and importantly, there's been a pretty significant increase in the production and use of disposable plastics. A lot of that, right, is also due to fears of spreading the virus through, for example, reusable shopping bags. But I would say a couple of key things are, in particular, there's a lot of plastics being used right now that are non-recyclable plastics, anything from things that are very difficult to recycle, made out of very thin types of plastics, from things like plastic bags to takeout containers to masks and gloves, right? And just as you showed with that clip from the policy, right, back in, was it January or early February, Illinois had just put forth some bills to phase out or single-use plastics in different ways. And they were just one of many states, right, or actually many countries, just in 2019 or at the beginning of 2020, banned different types of unrecyclable plastics. And in many areas, bills that were sort of in process have been stalled, or actually policies that were in place have been taken back or put on pause for a while. So that includes policies both from state and national governments, but also perhaps private businesses that had policies of using different types of plastics. So some of the issues from that are also just that this puts a strain on already strained waste management and recycling capacities here in the U.S. And in particular, for smaller towns or municipalities, this could have a big impact, but also at a larger scale, right? Other things that we see happening around the world are that recycling plants in some areas are refusing to take plastic that is even recyclable because of fears of propagating virus within those facilities. And I suppose last but not least, we see increase in litter. It's possibly gone down in some cities in the past few weeks, but especially at the beginning of the stay-at-home orders, right? People would go to the store or wherever and have a mask on and have some gloves on, and they don't want to bring that even into their car with them. So we saw an increase of litter on streets and parking lots, but also flowing through waterways, right? In the Chicago River and on ocean coastlines, where people are doing cleanups, we're seeing, in addition to other types, or actually decrease in other types of plastic pollution, and some cases increase in things like PPE. So we've
got just a couple of minutes left in our conversation, maybe even just 1 minute left. And Scott, I just want to end on asking you, you know, it strikes me that all these changes we've been talking about in the past few months, how quickly our habits can change and how quickly those changes can affect the environment. Are you encouraged by the idea that as we are moving forward, that people can change their habits, they will see results, that might make it easier to deal with climate issues?
So with the caveat that I'm not a social scientist, what has been pleasing is humankind's nature to see these positive changes and to be able to highlight them and to show what can be possible. So I'm hoping, while I actually expect that as restrictions are lifted, economic activity will pick up, people want to work, I'm hoping that folks seeing what's possible might spur further action. And, you know, as Professor Hansen said, a lot of the best action happens at home. The resiliency really happens at home, so that folks who have maybe come up with new habits can continue them post-pandemic and will get to like this new kind of normal.
Scott Carlos is an atmospheric scientist in the Environmental Science Division at Argonne National Laboratory. We've also been speaking with Anne-Marie Hansen. She's an environmental studies professor at the University of Illinois, Springfield. Thank you both for joining us today on the 21st.
Thank you very much, Brian.
Thank you for having us.
And that is all the time we have for today. Our show is produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.